The briskness of the air along the Grand Union Canal got in amongst Richard's senses and sharpened them up again. He was restored to his normal faculties, and though the fact of Gordon's death kept jumping at him all over again every few seconds, he was at least now able to think more clearly about it. Oddly enough, though, that seemed for the moment to be the last thing on Dirk's mind. Dirk was instead picking on the most trivial of the night's sequence of bizarre events on which to cross-examine him. A jogger going one way and a cyclist going the other both shouted at each other to get out of the way, and narrowly avoided hurling each other into the murky, slow-moving waters of the canal. They were watched carefully by a very slow-moving old lady who was dragging an even slower-moving old dog. On the other bank, large empty warehouses stood startled, every window shattered and glinting. A burnt-out barge lolled brokenly in the water. Within it, a couple of detergent bottles floated in the brackish water. Over the nearest bridge, heavy goods lorries thundered, shaking the foundations of the houses, belching petrol fumes into the air, and frightening a mother trying to cross the road with her pram. Richard and Dirk were walking along from the fringes of South Hackney, a mile from Dirk's office, back towards the heart of Islington, where Dirk knew the nearest life belts were positioned. "But it was only a conjuring trick, for heaven's sake," said Richard. "He does them all the time. It's just sleight of hand. Looks impossible, but I'm sure if you asked any conjurer, he'd say it's easy once you know how these things are done. I once saw a man in New York doing—" "I know how these things are done," said Dirk, pulling two lighted cigarettes and a large glazed fig out of his nose. He tossed the fig up into the air, but it somehow failed to land anywhere. "Dexterity, misdirection, suggestion, all things you can learn if you have a little time to waste. Excuse me, dear lady," he said to the elderly, slow-moving dog owner as they passed her. He bent down to the dog and pulled a long string of brightly coloured flags from its bottom. "I think he will move more comfortably now," he said, tipped his hat courteously to her, and moved on. "These things, you see," he said to a flummoxed Richard, "are easy. Sawing a lady in half is easy. Sawing a lady in half and then joining her up together again is less easy, but can be done with practice. The trick you described to me with the 200-year-old vase and the college salt cellar is," he paused for emphasis, "completely and utterly inexplicable." "Well, there was probably some detail of it I missed, but—" "Oh, without question. But the benefit of questioning somebody under hypnosis is that it allows the questioner to see the scene in much greater detail than the subject was even aware of at the time. The girl Sarah, for instance, do you recall what she was wearing?"
No, said Richard vaguely. A dress of some kind, I suppose.
Colour? Fabric?"
"Well, I can't remember. It was dark. She was sitting several places away from me. I hardly glimpsed her."
"She was wearing," said Dirk, "a dark blue cotton velvet dress gathered to a dropped waist. It had raglan sleeves gathered to the cuffs, a white Peter Pan collar, and six small pearl buttons down the front. The third one down had a small thread hanging off it. She had long dark hair pulled back with a red butterfly hair grip." "If you're going to tell me you know all that from looking at a scuff mark on my shoes like Sherlock Holmes, then I'm afraid I don't believe you."
"No, no, no," said Dirk. "It's much simpler than that. You told me yourself under hypnosis."
Richard shook his head. "Not true," he said. "I don't even know what a Peter Pan collar is."
"But I do," said Dirk, "and you described it to me perfectly accurately, as you did the conjuring trick. And that trick was not possible in the form in which it occurred. Believe me, I know whereof I speak. There are some other things I would like to discover about the professor, like, for instance, who wrote the note you discovered on the table, and how many questions George III actually asked. But—"
"What?"
"But I think I would do better to question the fellow directly. Except," he frowned deeply in concentration, "except," he added, "that being rather vain in these matters, I would prefer to know the answers before I asked the questions. And I do not. I absolutely do not."